I'm talking with NASA astronaut Rick Mastracchio. Welcome to the Space Show on Sudden FM.
Thank you for having me.
Rick, I just would like to start out, what involvement have you had in the return to flight effort?
Most of my work over the past 2.5 years since Columbia has been away from the return to flight effort. I just recently have been assigned to work STS-121, which is the second mission. I'll be capcomming. In other words, I'll be the capsule communicator with the crew during their mission. That's my primary assignment right now.
Okay, now STS-121 has kind of a dual role in that if called upon, it will be the STS-300 crew rescue mission. Will you be involved directly in that if that does take place?
Yes, as a capcom, I would be, yes.
And if that were to be required, what sort of turnaround from the decision that they make to call up the 300 mission, what happens? I guess everyone goes into panic mode.
Well, first of all, we wouldn't go into a panic mode, but obviously there's a lot of thinking has been done about this beforehand. If there is some kind of tile damage that we detect during the launch, we will inspect it on orbit with the new robotic arm boom and other sensors that we have on the vehicle. If we then decide that it's something that we can't repair, then the crew would take safe haven in the International Space Station. The crew is scheduled to dock with the space station on flight day 3, I believe. So what would happen is the crew would remain on board the space station. We would separate Discovery from the space station and dispose of it in the ocean, unmanned, obviously. And then Atlantis would be called up, and it would be launched after it was processed, just as if it was processed for its upcoming launch, but maybe in a little bit quicker manner.
The decision to go for the safe haven, I guess that would only be taken after, well, discovery of some damage on the vehicle, and then assessment as to whether the repair equipment that's on board would be able to be used and would be trustworthy enough to have a safe return?
Yeah, that's correct. It would be a very difficult decision. The first thing, obviously, is detecting it, and we have a lot of sensors and cameras to help us detect that, get some good photographs of it on orbit from the space station and from our new robotic arm boom. But once that data will then be sent to the ground, and obviously a lot of smart folks would be looking at that to make that decision whether it's something we can repair or we have to abandon the ship.
I guess if it's RCC, I guess there's really no repair equipment on board, or do they carry the patch technology on this?
I believe they are carrying it. I'm not 100% sure. I know STS-121 is bringing up the patch repair capability, and I'm not sure if 114 is, but I believe they are.
Okay, now I have your biography in front of me, and it actually shows you as being currently signed to STS-117. Have you had a flight assignment change?
I originally flew on STS-106 about 4 years ago, and I'm currently assigned to STS-117 as a crew member.
Okay, now tell me about your 106 flight. That was in September 2000.
That's right. It was a great mission. It was just prior to the International Space Station being permanently manned. We were about the third or fourth flight to the space station. Our primary mission was to bring up a lot of supplies, food, water, equipment, experiments to the International Space Station, stock up the space station in preparation for the first crew to move in. After our mission left the station, about a month later, the first crews have moved into the space station and have been living there ever since, of course, rotating every 6 months or so.
Do you have plans or ambitions to spend time aboard as an expedition crew member?
Well, I do what my bosses tell me to do, basically. But, yeah, of course, if after my next mission, 117, which flies hopefully in about a year, it's a very good possibility I'll be going to the expedition flow.
Okay. And what will 117's mission objectives be?
STS-117 is bringing up a piece of the starboard truss. The space station has a very large truss. It's going to be approximately 300 feet long when it's completed. It's built to hold large solar arrays to generate power for the International Space Station. It also holds radiators to dissipate heat. So we'll be bringing up a large segment of that truss work up there and installing it on the space station.
And your particular role in that mission will be?
My role will be as flight engineer during the ascent and entry phase of flight, and I'll also be doing a couple of spacewalks once we get on orbit.
And tell me about the ascent. As flight engineer, you're up on the flight deck behind the pilots, and tell me about that.
Yeah, that's correct. As flight engineer, basically you sit right behind the commander and pilot, in between them, more or less, and you have a pretty good view of all the instruments and a pretty good view out the window. So it's a pretty good seat, and I enjoyed it on 106, and again, I'll be doing that again on STS-117. But ascent is an incredible thing. It's a very dynamic phase of the flight. It's very exciting. There's a lot of vibrations in first stage, and then once you lose those solid rocket boosters after about 2 minutes, it's pretty smooth from there on out.
And you were flight a re-entry engineer in the same position on 106?
Yes, on entry I'll be in the same position. I'll be the flight engineer also.
So tell me about that experience. Obviously, I guess pre-Columbia 107, the re-entry was all sort of rather taken for granted as if all the drama was over. But obviously, you know, there is extreme environment and there's drama involved in it, even when the landing is successful.
Well, yeah. Well, some folks may have taken it for granted, but here at NASA, we obviously didn't. Entry is also a pretty dynamic phase. It's not as dynamic as ascent, but it's also very risky, and there's a lot of training that we have to go through the entry phase. But it's quite a bit different. It takes about an hour, whereas ascent's only about an 8.5-minute ride from the launch pad to orbit. Entry is more like an hour or so. And as you're re-entering the atmosphere, you're going about 17,000 miles an hour, and you have no engines, and you're basically just falling like a glider through the atmosphere. And, of course, you're going so fast as you go through the atmosphere, the friction with the atmosphere is creating great heat up to 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit around the vehicle. And that's where our thermal protection system protects us and keeps the vehicle safe. So you get a pretty good light show. Over in the overhead windows, you can see flashes of light out the front windows. The nose glows a different color as it gets hotter. It goes from yellow to green to white. And it's a great show.
The entry, it used to be in the Apollo capsule days, etc., you'd have a blackout during re-entry. Is that not the case now? Do you have continuous communication now?
Yeah, in the old days we did have a communication blackout, but now with our TDRS satellite networks and our ground stations, we have continuous communication with the ground during entry.
As capsule communicator, I guess, do you get involved in the training aspects with the crew, the flight crew, in a particular phases of their mission, and it's relevant to when you'll be on duty?
Yeah, very much so. As a capsule communicator, part of your responsibility is to understand the mission that you're going to be talking, that the crews are going to be doing. You're going to be talking to them about that. So I spend a lot of time basically side-saddling the crew through their training.
Okay, now for 117, you're assigned as an EVA specialist. Is that your first experience? Will this be your first experience on EVA?
Yes, on STS-106, I did not do a spacewalk, and this will be my first EVA on STS-117.
Okay, so you've got some exciting times ahead. Tell me about the training for spacewalking. I guess we've all seen the Vomit Comet, where you get 30 seconds of weightlessness, but that's not the bulk of your training, I take it.
Yeah, the majority of our training for spacewalks, or EVAs as we call them, is done in a large swimming pool. We call it the Neutral Buoyancy Laboratory, the NBL. And it's basically a large swimming pool, about 200 feet long and about 40 feet deep and 100 feet wide. And basically what we've done is we have models of the space station and models of the space shuttle under the water in this swimming pool. We climb into our spacesuits, our spacewalking suits, our EMUs, and they basically make us neutrally buoyant. We have scuba divers to make us neutrally buoyant so we don't float and we don't sink. And it has it's very closely simulates a weightless environment in space. And then we'll go through and we'll practice our different techniques that we're going to have to do on orbit in that swimming pool.
I've been told these spacesuits are like being inside like an inflated balloon, and I guess you need a fair bit of fitness. And tell me about the preparation or the training you do just to be able to operate effectively for that amount of time.
Yeah, the spacesuits are very stiff. You're in a vacuum environment outside the spacesuit, obviously, but inside the spacesuit, it's about a 4.3 psi pressure. And that difference in pressure doesn't sound like a lot, but it makes the spacesuit very, very stiff. And it takes a lot of effort and movement to open and close your hands, to move your arms and things like that. So it does. You have to be in pretty good shape in order to do these spacewalks. And basically we just spend a lot of time in the gym, and we just spend a lot of time in the pool practicing.
So the spacewalk itself, what will you be doing in that? There's three spacewalks?
Yes, there'll be three spacewalks on my mission. I'll be working on two of those. Basically, we're going to be connecting cables. Once you bring up a new piece of the truss, you got to connect a lot of electrical cables, data cables, computer cables, things like that. A lot of launch restraints. Part of this truss work that we're bringing up has solar arrays, and they're all folded up and stowed away so they can survive the launch loads. Part of our job will be to remove all the bolts, unstow those, unfurl them, and that takes quite a bit of time to get that done. That's what the three spacewalks will be for.
By that mission, I guess the testing or trialing of the tile repair systems will be complete. You won't have any involvement in that at that particular time?
Well, the tile repair testing is going to be an ongoing effort. Obviously, we have not mastered tile repair or RCC repair here at NASA. It's still in its very early stages, and so that's going to be an ongoing effort, I think, until we stop flying the space shuttle, would be my guess.
Do you have any thoughts or involvement in the next generation vehicle, the crew exploration vehicle, and what would you like to see in that?
Yeah, I did. I actually spent about 6 months or 9 months working on the some of the preliminary work for this, what we call the crew exploration vehicle, or the CEV, and it's a great challenge for NASA. I believe to go back to the moon and onto Mars is going to be very challenging, but I think once the International Space Station construction is complete, I think it's the right step, and I'm looking forward to working on it.
Would you like to get up to the moon yourself?
Yes, very much so. I'm getting a little bit up in age, but hopefully I could hold on long enough to maybe get a ride to the moon.
Well, thank you for joining us on the Space Show on Southern FM, and all the best with STS-114, the return to flight, and 121, where you're capsule communicator, and of course your next mission 117. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.